this is Tracy Swedlow, editor-in-chief of Interactive TV Today and the co-producer of the TV of Tomorrow show. Stay tuned, June 12th and 13th, coming up in San Francisco.
And this is Colin Dixon, founder and chief analyst at Endscreen Media. And this is Tea Time.
Tea Time.
We are here to talk about all things television. And we have a really interesting guest this morning who we'll get to in just a second. But one of the major topics I think we're going to be talking about is over-the-air broadcasting. And I noticed this morning, Tracy, there was news that over-the-air broadcasters in Britain are doing some strange things these days. There was an announcement that BritBox, which of course has been launched in the US for a year or so, which is a co-production of ITV and BBC, is actually going to launch in the UK. So that sounds a very odd move to me. So what do you think?
We've had BritBox at TVOT, by the way, for I think a couple of events. So it's great to see that they're getting more visibility. But why are they doing that? Are they competing with the BBC's iPlayer? What are they trying to accomplish here?
So I think what they're doing is that they have licensed some, BritBox has licensed some of that content on a worldwide basis, I think. They're also investing in some original content as well. And I think the idea here is to create a premium service which brings the best of ITV and BBC and the originals that isn't available through either of the broadcasters' traditional their own apps, and to package it in this product and allow people to subscribe to it.
So it sounds to me like they're doing what the iPlayer can do already, but they're going beyond that. You know, they're providing you with a lot more content that beyond the BBC can provide. There's more flexibility, perhaps, or just a different chance to come up with original content. Personally, if I can get the amazing documentaries that, you know, are on over there, I'd pay for that somewhere.
Right. And I mean, that's the selling point. The issue is that with iPlayer, there's only very specific windows that content is available in, and they're relatively short. And so
You cannot get iPlayer here.
Right,
unless
right.
Unless you know how to circumvent your browser, which is possible.
Right. But in the UK, it's a relatively short window that people have to watch stuff, and they disappear into the archives, and then it's actually quite difficult to watch. And so I think that's what the sweet spot is for BritBox in the UK. So I actually, it's the first time that the BBC and the ITV have worked together on a joint project. On an SVOD service like this in the UK. And I think it's a great move, actually. I think it's a good defensive move against companies like Netflix, and a good offensive move as consumers change their viewing behavior and move online and start looking for the large libraries of content. And of course, they're going to want the large library of UK content, which is actually pretty difficult to get hold of without a service like this. So I actually think it's a great opportunity for them, and I think they could well do quite well.
I think ITV is investing millions and millions of pounds in this.
Yeah, I mean,
like
both
up to 53 million.
I mean, both of them are investing lots and lots into this. So more power to them. I hope it's very successful. And the next time I'm in the UK, well, when it's launched, whenever that is, I will be checking it out for sure.
You've lived here so long, Colin. I always forget your English, except for the accent when I say, oh, he's English.
Occasional reminder.
Occasional. I think our special guest is calling in right now. He hasn't quite chimed in, but it's going to be Tim Hanlon, who is a well-known.
Hello.
There he is.
Hi, Tim.
Greetings. Hello, Colin. Hello, Tracy. How are you?
Oh, my God.
Good.
I love your radio setup. You sound like you're a sports announcer.
You do. Harry Carey or something.
Nothing like a little play-by-play in this crazy industry.
I was just saying, Tim, you are CEO of your consultancy called the Viterre Group, and you're located in Chicago, correct?
I am indeed, where it's, I would love to say it's beautiful and warm and come visit, but I would wait to any of your listeners. Give it a good couple of months before we figure out what spring looks like.
I live there. I know how cold it gets and how hot. It's all right. Anyway, We thought we'd bring you in on this because not only that, you know your stuff and you're at TVOT all the time and you raise your hand first, and we're really appreciative of that. You know this topic about OTA very well, and we wanted to get your insight into what's happening in that space, sort of an update on what's happening today, what's happening tomorrow. And Colin and I were just discussing the emergence of BritBox in the UK. But that's sort of an SVOD play. So we were curious.
A defensive play there, I think. You've got some data. You've been looking at this latest Nielsen data, which I've been looking at too. Kind of cool data. Why don't you catch us up?
Well, it's just short of stunning how the over-the-air viewership levels have increased over the last couple of years. And ironically, Nielsen being the data provider to tell us this. And I think it's interesting for a couple of different reasons. I mean, one, you know, free is free, right? It is no cost. And I think people are rediscovering that, or maybe frankly, for the first time for younger generations. There was a famous quote, I think, a couple of years ago in a Wall Street Journal article that was almost I'm paraphrasing, but there was almost an incredulousness by some of the interviewees of a younger age that they could actually receive these TV signals for free. They've almost felt like it was stealing or illegal in some way, shape, or form. And it's bizarre because I think in many respects, the broadcasting world has gone out of its way not to recommend or suggest or identify the path by which people can indeed get, quaintly, broadcast signals over the air via an antenna for free because of the rise of retrans fees that these broadcasters are now accelerating after years and years of complaining against their cable brethren. They're getting paid for their signals, and it's provided a very lucrative business for them outside of their core business, which was largely predicated on advertising. I'm just amazed how many people out there in the general populace recognize that they can get free over-the-air television with a simple antenna, and how it adds no cost whatsoever to whatever bundles that they may want to put together or recalibrate, given all this over-the-top video streaming phenomenon that we've been experiencing.
I've been pretty surprised too, Tim. I mean, the Nielsen says it's grown from 11 million in Q2 2010 to 16 million in Q2 2018. The thing that really shocked me when I really dug into the data was almost all of that growth, almost all of it has come from people that also have a connected TV platform. So they're using it in association with their online viewing.
Colin, I think they're cutting the cord, accessing their apps over the internet that they want, or, you know, using over the top platforms like Apple or, you know, Roku or whatever. And then when they want linear television content like the Academy Awards or certain sports, you know, or they want access to, you know, whatever, MeTV, you know, if it's being transmitted in their local area, they're plugging in that antenna.
They sure. I mean, the evidence is right there, right, Tim? I was looking at that. Nielsen did a superb job in this piece they put out, which we'll include a link when we post a discussion. But they did a superb job of breaking out the different segments of the OTA audience. And it's really surprising to see that if you look at the consumption, if you look at the group that don't use over the top, they consume TV just like regular TV viewers. They're watching nearly 5 hours a day of regular television, which is kind of shocking. But the group that use SVOD services are only watching about an hour and 37. And they're watching an hour up through an interconnected device. And they're also watching considerably less video than the non-SVOD household. So that seems to add up to what Tracy's saying, right? Wouldn't you say, Tim?
I agree. And I think there's a sort of another spin here, another little angle to this. And I think it comes down to what I generally sort of see as not only cord cutting, but unbundling. And frankly, what consumers are now doing, which is rebundling. And what that really means is that they're, as they've cut cords and shaved and really taken a hard look at their subscription pay television services collectively, both over the top and streaming video, as well as classic linear, you know, cable networks and those kinds of things. They're really starting to get very clued in to the various pricings of these different offerings. And, you know, one of the easiest re-ads or rebundle components when people put those pieces back together again, it's a no-brainer, really, to put broadcast television back into the mix. If it's as inexpensive as a, I don't know, $50 plus antenna, one-time payment with no subscription fees, it's essentially a free over-the-air bouquet of channels that adds very minimal, at least in the upfront, but over time, zero additional cost to whatever collection of streams and bundles one wants to put back together, right? So Netflix clearly rises to the top of a lot of people's lists. And then it gets interesting to sort of see, you know, what other sort of recombination elements come into play. And that's usually, you know, there's a whole sort of cadre of choices there. But at the end of the day, it feels to me that the idea of a, let's call it a broadcast bundle, right, is almost essentially an assumption or a no-brainer as part of one's going forward rebundled. Now, frankly, some may just want to keep over the air altogether, and that's it. That's fine. They don't want any more television from other sources. And, you know, we can argue and conjecture about sort of the relative audience quality of that, or the dynamics, or the psychographics of that sort of just over the air television kind of behavior, and frankly, the quality of that programming, you know, relative to all the other stuff. But at the end of the day, it's always, I think, going to be a pretty strong understanding that it's going to be a large component of just about everybody's newly crafted rebundles as they put them back together again. And that's pretty, to me, that's an interesting silver lining, I think, for broadcasting, save for other issues that, you know, could that are certainly challenging broadcasting at this moment.
Well, the broadcasters went out of their way to, of course, to get rid of Arrow TV, right? Which started out with Chet Kanoja years ago, and then was Barry Diller got involved. And when he invested, they really hard sued, and Arrow TV went out of business. And now there are still new apps appearing that want to take advantage of the antenna TV, essentially. And I just have become familiar with a new one called Locast, or Locast, L-O-C-A-S-T. They're offering access to broadcast content for free, but it's a nonprofit enterprise. You don't have to pay anything. You don't have to pay for the app. And yet there are other platforms like Air TV where you're paying for the box, you know, and or the antenna to download all this free content. I don't see why they haven't put these guys out of business as well. Locast feel they won't go after them because they're a nonprofit enterprise. What do you feel about these upstarts like Locast or Air TV? Do they have a chance?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, some of these are, you know, the Aereo case is very interesting on a whole different bunch of levels, right? But, you know, ostensibly it was quashed because of an interpretation of copyright laws, right? So, and Locast seems to be basically doing kind of the same thing. Their architecture is different, but obviously is claiming themselves as being a nonprofit, which indeed they are. And many people that I've talked to seems to be a fairly defensible and credible way of possibly, you know, assuming finances, right? But, you know, there's some other sort of things out there too, right? So the Digia folks have a broadcast service in, I think it's three markets, San Francisco, Bay Area, Los Angeles, and in Phoenix, called BTV, Broadcast TV, which essentially is an online friendly and or mobile friendly app. That basically takes all of the broadcast signals and DigiNets from each of those markets and makes them available as a subscription for, I don't know, I say it's $4.99, $5.99 a month. However, you know, with the carriage rights granted by said broadcaster. So the reality is that most of the channels available in that app right now are those kinds of channels that tend to be more must carry and public broadcasting and those kinds of folks. But it's, you know, a very interesting proposition when they get a few carriage agreements in place. And it actually, to me, that kind of thing actually brings up a really important topic here. And that's the integration thing, right? So you mentioned things like Air TV and even Locast and even just antennas, right? With a Mohu Leaf or whatever. There is an integration problem, right, or issue, right? I call it sort of the input problem, right, where I think the next sort of hurdle that has to be overcome, and I've seen a few workarounds, and that is how do you integrate these broadcast signals, right? In a market like Phoenix, you're talking about that's like 65 or 70 channels worth of stuff when you take all the main channels and the dot twos and the dot threes and put them all together. How do you make those visible and interoperable with all the over-the-top streaming channels and perhaps a virtual MVPD set of channels as well? How do you commingle those in a grid where they're all sort of, because they're coming from, you know, two or three different sort of sources, right?
I mean, who would the broadcasters sue though if you import that in to a platform paid for? I mean, that starts to get messy.
I know that. Well, I know that question's a little tongue in cheek, but here's the rub that I've always said since the Aereo case was determined, and this is why I like or am intrigued by at least a BTV Digit thing, as well as a Locaster and these other things, is that, you know, it's clear that consumers want and cherish broadcast television, and they don't mind the fact that it's relatively inexpensive or free over the air, but the integration problem is a challenge. The one thing that I find very interesting, it's still head scratching to me, is that the broadcasters have not, in the wake of the Aereo decision, have not created their own, shall we say, bundled, what I call broadcast bundle, right? A web and or mobile friendly app construct that allows people to access all of the broadcast channels in a market. Now, there are a number of stations individually and broadcast groups individually that are creating over the top video channels, but those are constrained, right? Those, you know, channel 45 in your marketplace, right, your over-the-top app, there are two issues. One, you've got, you know, every channel in the market's going to seemingly want to have its own over-the-top channel. So you're going to download 5, 6, 7 different apps for each individual TV station on your set or on your device. Then number two, the other real issue is that, you know, the ability for broadcasters to go directly to consumers is kind of lost when you go over the top, go over an over-the-air antenna. Right, it's an opportunity, I think, for broadcasters to create a viable broadcast bundle, go directly to the consumer, and perhaps get paid for these signals, not unlike they get paid for them in a cable or satellite subscription. So I find it interesting that the broadcast business would not want to create its own direct to consumer path and allow people an elegant way to ensure that broadcast signals were part of one's reconstituted bundle.
Right. And I think that goes back to what Tracy was saying, which is that they're really conflicted now with their retrans fees. And if you look at what strategically companies like CBS are doing, they really have no vested interest now that I can see in promoting or boosting usership of a free resource like a broadcast channel. Because what they really want is people to sign up for CBS All Access, where they can get access to their local channels that way. So I think there's a very weak, compelling reason for people in the broadcast industry to invest in their broadcast infrastructure.
I think also that they're trying to herd people into these platforms so that they get data, you know, back.
That's a big issue. Yeah.
It's surprising me that, you know, that they're not investing more proactively, more aggressively in ATSC 3.0, which is, you know, accepted by industry players like Tegna and Nexstar and Hearst and these kinds of companies. I mean, you think that they'd be rushing into all of those trials that are going on. Well, the one in Phoenix.
Yeah. Yeah. The interesting thing there, Tracy, at the TV of Tomorrow show, I think not last year, the year before last, Sinclair gave a fantastic presentation where they talked about how they were basically going to use ATSC 3.0 to launch, as it were, their own multi video platform in many markets. In the markets that they're present, I think they have about 8 channels, and they were planning on doubling or tripling or more the number of channels that they had available in each market based on ATSC 3.0. But they didn't wait. What they did was they launched Stir, and Stir is kind of what they were planning on doing with ATSC 3.0, but they're doing it today in this platform
themselves.
Which gives them which gives them all of that functionality right away. So that really begs the question, where the heck are we with ATSC 3.0? So you got any insight there, Tim?
Well, you mentioned STIR. I think that's an interesting segue into that, because one of the pieces of how stations, right, are at least now experimenting with over the top, right, there is a challenge there, right? Most of the stations really can only put out with rights, full rights, their news content, right? And the rest of the day of their schedule, whether it be syndication or network affiliate fare or sports or all those, tend to have other rights issues attached to them. So right now, it's very, very difficult for stations to fully simulcast or offer their over-the-air broadcast signal into their over-the-top apps. And that's why STIR is interesting, because they've created, STIR has, a marketplace, right, for content to allow stations to kind of fill in those hours where they don't have stuff, either from the stations themselves or from other sources looking to effectively syndicate. So again, it seems like a clunky solution, if you will, to a bigger, that could be more easily solved, I think, in a collective kind of app environment where one could subscribe and get all of the broadcast signals in a marketplace. But look, you know, we mentioned the segue to ATSC 3.0. You know, look, there still remains to be a lot of issues to be solved. Not technically. It seems like engineering-wise, it's going pretty smoothly. But I think from the business perspective, there seems to be a vast array of disagreement as to what to prioritize and then productize to take advantage of all this spectrum. But, you know, you mentioned one of those possible, at last count, I think there could be 25 or 26 different business models on the table for this kind of stuff, and maybe more. but one of those could be indeed, as you hinted at, a broadcast delivered multi-channel video service. And there is precedent for this. I don't know if you guys remember this. It's a little trivial for some people, but, you know, back in the first, back in the early to mid 2000s, when that first digital broadcast transition was going on, I remember vividly a little company out of Salt Lake City called USDTV.
Oh, and, my goodness. Yeah, right? Yeah, I remember those guys.
Right. And USDTV, if you remember, right, had, I think, three or four markets in the United States. And the proposition was, and I think it was a product for a little while until they ran out of money and could not get financing to go further, was literally to use broadcast spectrum to essentially create a bouquet of, you know, cable-like services, not only the broadcast signals, but also a select amount of cable networks, literally just over the air, but, you know, and a pay subscription thing. I think it was like $20 or $30 a month, something like that. So really, that idea is really just frankly being dusted off and being thrown out there as a possible and potentially very compelling use, among others, for what a broadcast signal can do. Why couldn't a broadcast signal bring a pay television bundle, perhaps inclusive, by the way, of broadcast signals? But it seems like a logical conversation to have and a business model to put on the table. And look, there's a lot of competing thoughts, though, about what to do with the spectrum. And I fear that the discussions and the, I don't know, it's called ulterior motives, but differing opinions, shall we say, of the various broadcasting partners out there, I'm a little worried that without a little bit more harmony collectively, it may not get to where it needs to be once and when it's uniformly available. God forbid there be some businesses to actually kind of take advantage of it once it's available.
Just in the to honor accuracy, USDTV was based in Draper, Utah, and they served Salt Lake City, Albuquerque, Las Vegas, and Dallas.
So, you know, we do seem to be in a funny position with ATSC 3.0, don't we? Because we've got the FCC under Ajit Pai have got their shoulder behind, if you like, ATSC 3.0. But they're not mandating it. It's not a requirement. What I hear from various people in the industry is that as broadcasters upgrade their infrastructure, they're upgrading with 3.0 capable equipment so that they can start broadcasting. We have zero TVs for sale in the US today that do ATSC 3.0, that are capable of recording ATSC 3.0 broadcasts. All of this, you know, we had the compelling reason for moving to an HD ATSC 1.0, as it were, infrastructure, because they were turning off analog. We don't kind of have that with ATSC 3.0. So that leaves me wondering, how long are we going to have to wait before we see it really roll out across the country and we see most channels move to that infrastructure? It seems like a long way off, wouldn't you say, Tim?
Well, actually, but before you answer, Tim, I wanted to just insert that Chris Ripley, who was the speaker, the CEO of Sinclair, about a year or two ago, said they were going to subsidize chips themselves, but I don't know about the status of that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We're recording this a couple of months before the NAB show, and my suspicion is that if there is any progress to be announced on a manufacturer or a chipset or timetable of how and when ATSC 3.0 ready sets or devices might come to market, I think that's the show to do that. And it would be, I think, frankly, a surprise in my mind if an announcement along those lines did not occur. And frankly, if it doesn't occur, then I'm really worried about sort of the timelines and whatnot. I think but it does come back to a little chicken and egg, right? So it's like, okay, it's one thing if the single frequency network architecture is working in markets, and it seems from an engineering perspective, all things seem to be working quite well. We've seen some research from MAGID that's been funded by the Phoenix Test Market Group, showing that there is consumer interest in a number of different, albeit still ill-defined, benefits of what this technology can bring from a television perspective. And to nobody's surprise, better sound, better picture clarity. But again, I keep coming back to this business model thing, right? Where what are the other things that this stuff can do, right? I think people in the industry sort of, salivate a bit about, the ability to get into some kind of pay television kinds of things, or getting into some kind of conditional access stuff, or the ability to do addressable targeted advertising over the air. Mm-hmm. Which I think is a huge, probably top one or two business priority. But then, the Spectrum Co. folks, look at it even on grander scale. They think that this is a data platform, and they could get them into other businesses outside of television and broadcasting altogether. And I think, frankly, and the public media folks even have their own sort of desires for what this is. So the irony, of course, is that they're all correct, right? The problem is that everyone's agenda, as it just outlined, can't be done all at the same time. There's a prioritization that has to happen so that product development and the engineering next step around that product development can happen. I don't doubt that the architecture of blanketing a market with 3.0 bandwidth goodness is possible, doable, and is occurring. What I am worried about is what the heck are we going to do with all this stuff? It seems to me it's very similar to the 5G questions that we heard at CES, right? 5G is basically coming. We've got some handsets. We've got some, the spectrum is basically getting lit up in a couple of places. Now, what do we do with it? I think still a lot of people don't quite yet know.
I wonder if they're trying to determine, is this best for conglomerates? Because those are the companies who are investing in this. Like I said, Tegna, Nexstar, Meredith, Raycom, Cox, Scripps, Hearst, Graham Media Group. Is it a more efficient way for them to manage their content and therefore deliver addressable advertising, like you said? Or are they looking to productize the news business? So I can't, or are they trying to capture the market of people out there who refuse to pay for television and just give them local TV as a kind of Trojan horse, and as an on-ramp to more types of content?
Yes, I doubt that it's the last. I doubt that it's that last part, Tracy, because one of the interesting things in that Nielsen research was they broke out not only that group that is broadcast only, but also the sort of demographics. And I got to tell you, it's not a great market. I think the household income is half of the household income of the group that also combine broadcast with SVOD, for example. One of the things Tim said talked about a little bit at the beginning was he talked about the integration of all of that. And I can tell you that there is one company out there that really totally gets this, and that is Amazon. Now, Amazon did something which I thought was kind of crazy, and I still do think it's kind of crazy. They put out this they put out this OTA receiver called the Recast, and I have one sitting looking at one right now in my office. And this thing is a big box with a big hard drive that you plug into your antenna and you plug into your home network. And it talks to your Amazon Fire TV. And all of the broadcast content now is integrated into that Amazon experience. Now, why does that matter? Well, it matters to Amazon because, remember, Amazon is also aggregating aggregating together SVOD. So when you do a search now inside of this Fire TV box for content, you pick up everything. You pick up the broadcast content, you search that library of content, you search Amazon's library of Prime Video content, and you search the library of the SVOD providers that they're reselling. And that's the big win for Amazon. But it's a pretty big win, I will say, for consumers as well, because it provides a really nicely integrated experience. It's among the easiest that I've come across integrating OTA. So there are plenty of approaches here, and it sounds like getting that integrated experience is getting easier to me, right?
No, I think that that's the biggest issue that has to be solved across the ecosystem is indeed that it's guidance and navigation, recommendation, and all that. I've been, a big user and booster of TiVo for ever since they were born, right? And I've using their platform, it's been relatively easy for many, many years to kind of have all those things integrated into one environment, including over the top apps. And it feels to me like a lot of the MVPDs, both classic and virtual, are rushing to at least do that within a pay television bundle environment, whether it's skinny or fat or somewhere in between. But it's where, when things are more elemental and completely separate, right? So that rebundling exercise, that's where there's still quite a bit of friction to combine all those things together. And you're right. I think in Amazon is a unique place. And there could be a few others for all I know.
Yeah, I like Channel Masters Stream Plus as well. That's a pretty good product. Works pretty well. And like you, I'm a big fan of TiVo. I've got the Bolt, and that's a really slick integration of OTA and SVOD. So and DVR. So there are plenty out there.
Yeah, and just as more choice comes our way, and they're not just linear channels, right? They're just shows and binge drops and all that kind of stuff. And people just literally they're all being basically content's being published. And how do you get that published content found and then be able to sit back or lean forward and enjoy that? And I think that's the secret sauce that I think really has to improve. And, that's really when consumers will really rejoice, I think, versus I think right now it's kind of a wild west, right? If you're an average consumer, I'm surprised. I will say this in my travels, when I talk to people and I do quiz them for business purposes, of course, what their television viewing experiences are, how they watch TV, well, all that kind of stuff. I am flabbergasted, actually not anymore, but about how sophisticated people have become about their cable bill, unbundling, and the various workarounds that they, without prompting, go right into as to how they watch or consume or don't consume various forms of television and video. So it's very, I think the what I find is interesting is I think the industry doesn't give consumers yet a lot of credit for just how sophisticated they've become in terms of knowing what their options are versus just taking a big pay TV bundle. And I think it's be very interesting to watch the next couple of years as that reality starts to further play out as it's already started.
Tim, do you think that these types of services, or maybe it's happening in Phoenix, do you think that there's a chance that working with local advertisers, or is that small change?
No, I think you're sort of hinting at sort of the idea of smaller advertisers being able to more self-serve, not unlike say what they can do with Google AdWords or Facebook's mm-hmm. platform, that kind of stuff. I think that's inevitable, but it all starts though with a commitment to improve the product of advertising in broadcast television. Call that addressability, call that programmatic, maybe it's a combination of the two. In my mind, the answer to that question, to me, that's a feature of what in my mind should be the prioritized first business model of ATSC 3.0, which is advanced addressable targeted advertising. It is a weakness of broadcast over the air television, broadcast television in general, the inability to really apply data and or target sub DMA level. All right. It doesn't even have to be a household, right? I'm talking zip code. I'm talking region or county. I mean, just something sub DMA. Broadcast can't do that. It doesn't do that. And it is now, I would argue, not a positive differentiator. It's actually a negative one now, given that you can locally slice and dice in MVPD environments for advertising and a whole host of digital things. Frankly, broadcast television on the local level actually is now the outlier than it is the mainstream provider. So that, to me, and again, from an advertising bias, admittedly, that to me feels like the greatest priority. If I was in the room trying to put business models on the whiteboard, number one for me would be targeted, addressable, data-driven, programmatically enhanced advertising.
Yeah, and you go backwards to saying it. How does it get integrated into an app? Because that's the only way they'll be able to collect data. That's still the challenge.
Well, and there
which
you have
you're right
it.
To point out.
And that's why I think our friends at Sinclair would have done stir. They haven't waited. They've gotten on with it. That's why Tegna is there as well, producing original content.
Think back as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is an interesting subject. I'm sure this is something that we're going to get back to again and again in the future here, Tracy. But I think we're probably just about out of time here.
Well, I have to say, all of these companies are going to be at TVOT, so we'll be discussing every single subject that we brought up.
I think we talk about ATSC pretty much every time, so I'm sure there'll be something there about ATSC 3.0 as well. Tim, thank you so much for joining us. Fascinating conversation.
I appreciate you having me. Thanks very much, guys.
And Tim, what's your podcast? Tell everybody about what you do.
Oh, it's completely different. It's in the world of sports. And if you fancy yourself a sports fan, especially of teams and leagues no longer with us or defunct or previously domiciled, it's called Good Seats Still Available. You can find it wherever good podcasts are found. And you can also find out more on the website at goodseatsstillavailable.com. And thanks for asking.
Uh-huh. That's why he sounds so much like a sports broadcaster, because he is.
Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for listening. You'll hear us again soon.
All right. Thanks again. Go to the TVOfTomorrowShow.com. Please get your tickets before 2 days, I think. The early, super early birds price is up. Anyway, little self-promotion never hurts. Thank you so much, Colin.
Thank you, Tracy.
This is tea time. Stay tuned for another episode.